perished. They must never know. Promise me, Edward.
Edward had promised.
On their way into the mountains, they had driven past sleeping little Gold Hill that looked like a broken toy town from the Old West. They would have a funeral soon. They would bury an empty box and tell the congregation Mother was gone. Only Edward and Father would know the truth. The sled hit a hidden branch and there was a thump inside the box. Edward placed his hand on the wooden lid. She couldn't feel his touch through the wood, but perhaps she could sense him out here, with her, keeping her safe. Perhaps she knew how sorry he was.
When they reached the mine, Father took a ring of keys out of his pocket. The sun was already melting the snow on the tailings pile, seeping into naked patches of gold-brown gravel. In the morning sunlight, in his long dark coat and heavy snow boots, Father was tall and solemn and magnificent.
"This is not your fault," said Father.
He unlocked the gate.
It opened with a rusty groan.
"You must understand that, Edward. It is my fault. We are gifted with the safekeeping of this great and terrible thing. But I grew careless. She is more ancient than we can imagine, and more cunning, and she has only ever been a tool for us to use in our mission. We were foolish to forget that."
Father had never called her a thing before. The word made acid churn in Edward's stomach. She was great, and she was terrible, but she wasn't a thing. She was a gift, a wonder. There were monsters everywhere in the world. They needed her to cure them. Edward couldn't go back to hunting them like wild animals. There was a better way, and that better way was Mother.
Edward waited until his father's back was turned and picked a sharp stone the size of a baseball. It sat heavy in his pocket, a solid weight bumping his thigh.
"Help me carry it," Father said.
Edward ducked his head to hide his scowl. He heard the quiet thump, thump of hooves inside the box and the scratch of claws on wood. He would never forget. He would never make the same mistakes Father had made.
"Yes, Father," Edward said,
and he followed. Chapter 37. Night was coming, and with it a cool, whispering breeze. I felt the rock in my hand and the impact of every blow. I remembered it as though I had killed the man myself only minutes ago. I remembered blood splattering over the wooden box that held the woman who was not a woman, the thing called Mother. His real mother had died after that terrible night when he was a child. I didn't know her name. She had only wanted to escape, get away from her abusive and controlling husband, get away from the trap they called community, but probably meant cult. I only knew what Willow had known as a child, so I had no idea how she had known the monsters, what they were or where they came from, only that she had called them old friends. I didn't even know if she was one of them. She only wanted a chance to slip away in the night. A few fires, a few broken windows, a desperate woman's desperate plan. It might have worked if Edward hadn't warned his father. I wished I knew her name. She deserved to have somebody remember her name. I left Willow's body on the forest floor. Everything smelled like blood. I found the keys and the flashlight, and I walked back to the mine. There were three keys on the ring, and only one was shiny and new. The padlock opened with a click. The gate was heavier than I expected. I braced my feet against the soft gravel, gripped the metal bars, and leaned. I pulled it open just enough for me to slip through. "Okay," I said. Cold, cold air flowed from within the mountain. The hair on the back of my neck
Rose. I had Violet's warnings, Brian Kerr's memories, Mr. Willow's promises. Unreliable data. All of it. None of it told me what I needed to know. I pointed the flashlight into the mine and started walking. There were no metal tracks along the ground, no wooden beams and frames holding back the mountain. All of my ideas about old Western mines had come from Looney Tunes in Hollywood, and to my great surprise, they hadn't quite gotten it right. The tunnel was rough, blasted and chipped away in sharp angles, supported in a few spots by rusted bolts in the rock. Just inside the gate, where daylight still penetrated, there were cans and bottles, food wrappers, used condoms, cigarette butts. A charred fire ring stained the stone floor. That seemed like a terrible idea to me. But I guess if you thought getting drunk and having sex in an abandoned mine was a good idea, you probably thought lighting a campfire was, too. The tunnel sloped downward. After 100 feet or so, there was no light from outside and no trash, either. The ceiling was so low in places I had to duck. Brian Kerr must have come out with a sore back and a headache every time. Water seeped through cracks and gathered in puddles. There was no way around, so I splashed right through. Then my shoes were slick, making every step treacherous. The flashlight caught a glint of something shiny ahead in the darkness. I stared at it. I wasn't watching my step. I set my foot on a crooked cut of rock and lost my balance. I fell, slammed my elbow into the wall so hard I yelped and dropped the flashlight. It rolled away and flickered, and I thought, for one terrified moment, the filament would break and I would be left in the darkness. But it still glowed with sickly yellow light. I exhaled with relief. I climbed to my feet, leaning on the wall for balance. I had twisted my ankle, but I could walk. Uphill was out. Downhill was in. I hadn't passed any forks or junctions or obstacles. Even if the light died, I could find my way back. Uphill was out. The flashlight had rolled to a stop against a pile of broken glass, the remains of a large jar. The shards lay like leaves on the tunnel floor, and the curve of the neck rested against the wall. That was the bright reflection that had caught my eye. I retrieved the flashlight and hurried past. The second gate was orange with rust, and its iron grid was dented and warped. This time there was no doubt about it. It had been struck from the inside. I knew the hinges would creak when I pushed it open. Brian Kerr had winced every time. One of his victims, an older woman, had laughed at him. There was a large round rock just outside the gate that had obviously been set there for the purpose of holding it open. I rolled the rock into place and let the gate fall against it. The scent of the mountain's exhalations grew stronger as I descended. At first I thought it was only stale air. But it was more than that. It was mold and damp, and the dark corners of my grandmother's cellar where strange flat mushrooms used to grow. Meadow and I had dared each other to poke them with a broom handle, half expecting them to recoil. I kept walking, and the smell grew worse, like a sick room closed up for too long, or the unwashed clothes and sour scent you catch when you pass a homeless man on the street and can barely see a human beneath the layers of jackets and sweatshirts as thick as plates of armor. It was oldness, illness, and sweet fruit rotting in an alley dumpster. I imagined a garbage dump down there in the darkness, carted in from the surface in wheelbarrows of breaking plastic bags. A thought so absurd, laughter bubbled and nearly escaped before I caught it. I gagged and breathed through my mouth. But that only meant I could taste it on my tongue. So I stopped breathing. It didn't cut out the smell entirely, but it helped. I had no sense of how far I was walking. I didn't know how long I had been underground. The surface could have been 1,000 yards or 1,000 miles behind me. Beyond the second gate, I found the first skeleton. It wasn't a complete skeleton anymore. It was a pile of bones strewn along the tunnel, tangled in scraps of cloth that had once been clothes. Skull, ribs, pelvis, clavicle, the dirty white knobs of a scattered spine. I didn't recognize the clothes. Whoever it had been, they hadn't earned a permanent place in Brian Kerr's memories. The rotten stench grew stronger with every step. I was looking forward, not down, and I kicked the second skull before I saw it. It skittered down the tunnel like a soccer ball, knocking from side to side, until it stopped against the third skeleton, which wasn't so much a skeleton as a mummified corpse. Its desiccated, blackened flesh pulled away from its teeth in a comical grin. Its arms were reaching uphill, toward me, but somebody had carelessly knocked one of its hands free. It still wore a watch on one wrist. Plastic, pink. There was a darker smear on the dark stone around the body. It didn't look like a girl anymore. It didn't look like anything except a corpse. I stopped counting after that. I could hear them in the incomplete memories I had taken from Brian Kerr, but I couldn't match the screams and pleas to the withered corpses and loose bones and dried blood. There was no sound except my footsteps and my own thudding heart, but my mind was a cacophony of fear and anger. A man screamed over and over again that he would do anything, anything, please, anything! A child cried for her father. A young woman shouted a stream of creative expletives until her voice gave out. Hands scrabbled on stone, blood flowed and pooled, and one by one they died. The third gate looked much like the second. Iron, rusted, solid but bent outward. It had been rammed repeatedly, with great force, from the inside. The stench was so strong it made my eyes water and my stomach turn. There was no body slumped against the gate. I could see Father's corpse so clearly in Mr. Willow's memory I was momentarily confused to find it gone, even though it had been more than 40 years. The man had collapsed in an ungainly heap, and Edward, 14 years old with blood on his hands, had continued on his own, dragging the box with the creature inside. I had no memory of what he had done with his father's body. Beyond the gate there was another jar. This one was unbroken and upright. And after it, marching into the darkness, clusters of them set up against the walls of the tunnel. They were stacked 3 or 4 high in places, in squat little pyramids, glass jars of all shapes and sizes. Nothing in Brian Kerr's or Mr. Willow's memories told me how the jars had gotten there, and that unsettled me as much as the relentless darkness. I found the third key on the ring and slid it into the lock. A soft, wet noise filled the mine, distant and quiet. She was laughing. Chapter 38. She knew I was coming, and she was laughing. As soon as I recognized the sound for what it was, there was nothing else in my universe. No surface, no gates, no peaceful forest of vanilla-scented trees beneath a clear night sky. The world shrunk down to that throat of stone, the yellow light before me and oppressive darkness at my back, old corpses and old blood, and the mocking laughter. I could lie down at the gate and let that cruel, distant laughter wrap around me, fill me, suffocate me. And I wouldn't even fight it. This must be what they feel like when I kill them. The thought was like a slap to the face, and the flash of anger cleared my mind. I wasn't a screaming captive being dragged into the darkness. I wasn't pleading and begging. If that's what she expected, she was going to be disappointed. I was here to meet her, one monster to another. The laughter faded, but I could feel it on the cusp of bursting forward again. My hands were sweaty. The broken skin stung where I had scraped my palms. Every muscle in my body was tense. Every nerve sparking. I turned the key and stepped through the gate. Made sure I could get out again before letting it swing closed. I kept the key ring out and the last key between my fingers, like they teach you to do in parking lots late at night. The flashlight barely penetrated beyond the gate. I approached the stack of jars against the wall, choosing each step with care. The stone was rougher here, the walls more jagged, the floor treacherous with loose sand and gravel. It looked as though something had scooped great gouges out of the rock. I pressed the toe of my shoe into one depression, studied the parallel lines. Almost like claw marks, I thought, with hollow disbelief. I lifted my hand to measure the span of one trench on the wall. Small hands, whoever wielded those claws, no bigger than mine. The grooves were stained dark in places. I touched the stone lightly, curled my fingers away. If it was blood, it was long dry. I inched forward, slowly past the first stack of jars. Six large mason jars, the kind Melanie's mother used for making pickles and preserves every fall, each sealed with a rusted metal lid. I pointed the flashlight down the tunnel, and something in the darkness rasped and shifted. I froze, took a step to the side, away from the jars. There was a flutter of motion at the corner of my eye. It was the sand. My heart jumped, beating wildly without my permission. The sand in the jars was moving, rasping and scraping behind the glass. But when I looked at it directly, it settled with a whisper. I turned my head, forced myself to look down the tunnel. The sand moved in a nervous dance at the edge of my vision. When I stared at it, it was still again. A minute or two passed before I could make myself move forward. The hiss of shifting sand followed me. The jars were all shapes and sizes, some new enough to have labels still clinging to them, others so old the glass was tinted green. I counted at first, numbers ticking nervously through my mind, but gave up when I got to 50. I squeezed myself gingerly through a gap between two precarious stacks, and the tunnel opened up. The flashlight didn't reach very far, but I could see the walls had been scraped out in odd alcoves and hollows, the floor so uneven I had trouble choosing my steps. The stone took on a lumpy, diseased look, as though the mountain's insides had erupted into boils and wounds, giving it a queasy funhouse feeling. Every motion of light caught another glint of glass, another shy shiver of sand, another jagged gap of rock. I closed my eyes to steady myself, but the rustling of sand rose to an unbearable roar, so I snapped them open again. And I moved forward. This is where they had found her. The knowledge rose in a memory stolen from Edward Willow. His father had explained it to him as they carried the wooden box between the first gate and the second. The elder Mr. Willow had come here with fellow hunters. Cruel and violent men, he told his son, not to be trusted, because they had heard of a terrible creature hidden away in the mountain. She had been imprisoned here for nearly 100 years, but she was unfathomably ancient, unlike any monster they had encountered before. The elder Mr. Willow and the others had come to kill her. She would make a magnificent prize for their collection, so unique and so vile, a foul, withered head to hang in a place of honor. When I glanced back, I couldn't see the gate anymore. I turned, and the flashlight caught a bright, glittering spot in the darkness, but lost it again. A trophy. That was what they wanted. The elder Mr. Willow had wanted it, too. He had wanted it until they found her cavern. And she spoke to him, and she told him there was a better way. The cavern bristled with the susurrus of restless sand, and something else, a gentle clink like a wind chime. Metal on glass. She had said to him, "There is so much blood on your hands already, and still there are families in danger as yours once was, and still there are children whose mothers will betray them. There is a better way." That was why he took her out of the mine. He brought her back when he realized he could never control her. That brief taste of freedom had only made her angrier. I shook my head to clear it. Willow's memories were distracting and disjointed, a jigsaw of childish guilt and teenage rage, two dead parents and the monster who had taken their place. The light caught a golden glint again. A single yellow eye shone in the darkness. I stopped. My shoe scuffed on stone. I drew in a long, shaky breath, the first I had taken in several minutes. My mouth was dry. "Hi," I said. Her laughter was like thunder, rolling and strong. I felt it in the air, in my teeth, in the ripples of my sluggish blood. "Most of them don't make it this far down," she said. The sand in the jars fell still when she spoke. I was expecting an animal growl, ancient, wild, as wretched as the stench that filled the mine. But her voice was human. Ugly, phlegmatic, chain-smoker rough. But human. I had no trouble understanding her. She turned, and there were two yellow eyes before me, round and wide with rectangular black pupils. Those yellow eyes, and the hump of a single shoulder, that was all I could see of her. I couldn't see how large she was. Couldn't see her feet, her hands, her mouth. She was cloaked in the shadows, and I was very, very small. "Where's my boy?" she said. "He couldn't make it," I said. "Unconscious in a hospital bed, never to wake again. Limp and dead on the forest floor." I didn't know if she was asking about Brian Kerr or Mr. Willow. I didn't want to tell her what I had done.
"Come closer. Let me look at you."
"I'm fine right here." She coughed and spat.
"I want to see you. You are a pretty thing."
She moved with lurching, unsteady steps, vanishing behind a stack of jars and reappearing on the other side. And there I could see more of her body. Her back was so bent her torso was nearly parallel to the floor. She wore filthy rags and a blanket stiff with grime. Gray hair hung in a dirty mat around her face. There was a sound like a sniff, the smacking of lips, but her face was hidden by a fold of cloth. She stepped behind a tower of jars again.
"Yes,"
she said, her voice floating in the darkness.
"I have not seen such a pretty thing in a very long time."
I watched the spot where I had last seen her, but I couldn't hear her footsteps. There was more space down the tunnel than I had realized. I couldn't see how deep the cavern went. "But you have before," I said. "You've seen something like me?"
"Oh, yes," she said,
and she laughed again, loud and hearty, ringing through the cavern.
"Oh, yes, my dear. Did you think you were the only one? Did you think you were so very alone?"
"Yes," I thought, but I kept my mouth closed. The sand trembled. I took a step back, bumped my elbow into a precarious stack of jam jars sealed with wax.
Oh, my dear, it must be so very frightening."
Her voice was as rough as a fall of rocks, but there was a softness to it, a gentleness that crept under my skin and soothed my jittery nerves. She wasn't a wild animal. She wasn't a ravenous monster raging out of control with her own anger and spite. She was intelligent and calm, and she knew about me.
And you are so young. You have been alive barely a heartbeat.
A little bit longer than that, by our standards, but I couldn't say it out loud. The way she said, "so young," made me feel like I was a child again. So small I had to reach up to grab my mother's hand in the grocery store. When Comfort had been looking up from the bewildering maze of legs and carts and shelves to see her smile and her eyes, to hear her say my name and tug me along. I swallowed down the sting at the back of my throat.
By their standards,
she corrected gently.
But too short, even by that measure. You are far too young to have suffered so cruel a fate.
My vision blurred, and I raised my hand, still gripping the keys, to scrub away tears before they fell. In her voice was all the pity I had been pretending wasn't eating me from the inside. The childish wail of unfairness gathering in my chest like a summer storm.
And why shouldn't you rage? Why should you choke down this anger you so deserve?
She was moving again, and that time I did hear the soft tap-tap of her footsteps. Uneven. Every step a slow pause and lurch. Pause and lurch. She moved with a limp so pronounced it twisted her entire body. She stepped around a stack of jars, turning to fit through the narrow gap. I heard a long scrape, a rasp that set my teeth on edge. Metal grinding on rock with slow, slow patience.
You are too brief and too small to suffer so,
she said. When she turned again, she was holding a large jar under one arm. With the other hand, she tipped a handful of sand into it. Stray grains fell from the wall behind her, cascading softly from thin parallel scrapes in the wall. Her fingers, claws, clinked on the jar's mouth. They were crooked and mismatched, oddly twisted, not smooth like Lyle's.
How it must hurt, my dear, my poor dear.
Another step closer to the light, and I had a better view of her hand. Her claws didn't look like claws because they weren't, not in the usual sense. The long blade twisting from her thumb was fashioned from a piece of rusted metal, and curving from her forefinger around the top of the jar was a yellow bone sharpened to a point.
"Oh, my dear,"
she said, the words like a chant.
"Tell me how it hurts."
I tore my gaze from her makeshift claws.
"It doesn't," I said, a ragged whisper. And how I wanted it to be true.
But in my mind, a different answer screamed.
"Yes, yes, it hurts. I hate it. I hate this alien body that bleeds and breathes only when I make it. I hate that everything I had before is now out of my reach. However little I had collected in 17 short years of an unremarkable life."
"You are not alone, dear child, my dear. You do not have to feel this pain alone."
The scream in my head became the screams of a dozen strangers led into darkness and trapped behind iron gates. Then the strangers' voices faded, and there was only the scream of one girl surprised on a quiet street, face distorted in a windshield, street lamp like a full moon overhead.
"You know there is a way to make it better."
She spoke with infinite patience, the kind of patience that came from being mother to 1,000 recalcitrant children, not one of whom wanted to go to bed on time.
I don't, I said.
My child, she said. You do. Mother knows you do.
There was her laughter again, gentle and fond. The sand quivered around me, dizzying and unsteady, the entire cavern coming to life. I squeezed my eyes shut. She did know. She knew what I needed to hear, knew what I had come to learn. She knew what I wanted, and she was laughing because it was such a simple thing. Such a simple little thing for something so ancient and fearsome as her. I only had to ask, and she would laugh again, and I would laugh with her, and everything would be better. When I opened my eyes, I couldn't see her. My heart thumped. Had it been still until that moment? I was losing track of my own pulse, losing the feel of blood in my veins. Every heartbeat, conscious or not, trembled in my throat and threw my skin to sink into the stone. I couldn't see her. Not her eyes, not the crooked hump of her shoulder, not her mismatched claws. The cavern was dark, but not very wide. She couldn't have slipped away. I held my breath and listened. There was no tap-tap of feet. Shoes? Bare feet wouldn't make that sound. It was too solid. A click. I don't know what I can do about it, I said again. That's why I came to you. I aimed the flashlight into the shadows, looked forward and back, took a couple of steps farther into the mine, and stopped. With every movement, I was too aware of the tight space growing tighter, as though the jars were shuffling behind me to close off my escape. I really don't, I said. I cleared my throat, hoped my voice sounded steadier than I felt. Know anything. I don't know anything.
Oh, my child, she said.
I spun around. The word slithered over my shoulder, teased the cup of my ear. But she wasn't there. There were only the jars full of sand, shuddering at the corners of my eyes.
How lonely it must be, she said.
Her voice bounced and carried unpredictably. I turned again, my back to the gate now. I had to remember that, remember where the gate was. Down was in. Up was out.
And if it is lonely now, how lonely it will be as years and years and years go by.
We're supposed to be talking about me, I said, not you. Her laughter rippled through the sand. The more I cast the light around, looking for her, the more confused I became. Every scraped alcove, every stack of jars taking the shape of a stooped old woman.
Yes, she said. It was a human thing not too long ago, was it not? I can smell its blood. I can taste its breath. Mother knows. It cannot lie to Mother.
A scrape. A scattering fall of sand on glass, filling the jar. I edged forward and searched along the walls, in the dark spaces behind the stacks and piles. She had to be hiding somewhere. I stepped sideways between the jars, back toward the gate. I had come too far in. I shouldn't have put that much space between myself and the way out. That was stupid. Careless. I could hear the dying screams of Brian Kerr's victims in my memories. I had brought them in here with me. But I was so used to the memories of strangers dying, I had forgotten to listen. Yes, I said. I was human not that long ago.
I know, little lamb. Mother knows.
Her breath was hot and rancid on the back of my neck. I turned slowly, slowly, my heart jumping uncontrollably. I hadn't heard her approach.
I hadn't seen any flicker of motion from the corner of my eyes, hadn't heard the tap-tap of her feet on the floor. But she was there, barely 2 feet away, stinking and crooked and grinning. She had a fat, round jar under one arm, and from the other hand she was dribbling a trickle of sand through its mouth. Her fingers were long and filthy, stained dark deep in the creases, each one ending in a knot of scar tissue and a fashioned claw. Twists of metal, sharpened bones, curving dirty and bloody from her fingertips. Fresh red blood welled from one knuckle.
"Did you bring me a gift?"
she asked. I stepped back, kicked a jar behind me. It rocked, but didn't fall. "What kind of gift?"
"Gifts of stupid girls who ask questions they already know the answers to," she said.
"Yeah, that was kind of a stupid question." My voice was shaking. I pretended not to notice. "But I have another one that's not as stupid."
"Look at you,"
she said, laughing. How could I have thought she sounded like my mother? There was no kindness in her voice, no gentleness.
"The dead thing with all the questions. 3 keys and 3 locks, and it thinks it can ask me questions."
She stepped closer.
"Go on, then," she said. "I like a present that talks with words."
I spoke quickly, before I could change my mind. "Why do you let some of them go? The ones who don't die or go insane. You let them walk away. Why?"
"Why?"
She was laughing again.
"Why? Why? It wants to know why."
"Yes, I want to know why." The sand in the jars hissed around me. I flinched one way, then the other, but there was no space for me to shrink away. When I stepped back, she stepped forward. I didn't want her near me. I didn't want her close enough to touch. Her feet, hidden behind her cloak of rags, clicked on the stone. There was something wrong with her legs.
"That is not what it wants. Nobody comes to Mother to ask questions."
The jars quieted. I stepped back. And again. I couldn't remember which way was out. I didn't know if I was moving uphill or down. My foot crunched on a broken jar. She caught me with those yellow eyes. And I stopped.
"Ask me what it wants, dead thing. Even a dead thing can ask what it wants."
I swallowed.
"Oh, my dear, dearie dear," she said. "Let Mother take its pain away. You know what it will become if it keeps it for itself, greedy little creature."
I shook my head. I couldn't make myself speak.
"It knows. It does. I can taste its fear. I can taste how much it wants. All the wicked, wicked things in the world, and now it can see them. Now it can hunt them. Stalk them through the night, and they won't even know it's there. They won't ever see the nasty black thing behind the pretty child's mask until they're already dying. I can taste how much it wants that."
"No," I said, and I was shaking my head, and I was remembering what I had seen in Ingrid's house, that vision of myself powerful and strong, moving over the landscape like a shade that left no trace except the bodies of fallen killers. "No, stop! That's not what—"
"I can taste how scared it is. Little child, what a wretched thing you will become."
She was right in front of me. Her mouth was a red gash.
"I know it is frightened. Mother can help. Ask me if I can take it away. Ask me if I can carve it out like a festering wound. They told it, wretched dead thing, go to mother. She has an appetite like maggots. Go to her in the darkness, and she will take away the putrid rot, the stink it carries. Mother will gnaw and gnaw and gnaw until it's gone. She'll take your gift and keep it here in her pretty glass cages.
All around us the sand shivered.
Go on, go on, ask. Ask me if I can reach inside and tear out all its ugly worms and keep them here with me. Ask me if the dead thing can be alive again.
I couldn't speak. I wasn't breathing. My heart wasn't beating. I was shaking so much the flashlight beam danced over the tunnel, glinting off the smooth curved jars. But her yellow eyes with their angular black pupils never wavered.
Ask me!
She roared. The walls shook and the trapped sand quivered. My heart jump-started with a painful kick. One small jar, still carrying a label for baby food, slipped from a stack. It fell to the floor and shattered. The sand snaked away in twisting, spidery lines. When the sand was still and the ringing in my ears faded, I whispered, "Can you?" She laughed again, but quietly, an amused chuckle so much worse than her loud, wild laughter. Limping and swaying, she shuffled a few steps, gathering up her blanket with one hand. Beneath the folds of fabric, her legs were covered with coarse black hair, and they bent the wrong way, and the feet at the end weren't feet at all, but hooves.
Sweet dead thing, give me your rotten little heart. It's a good gift. You won't miss it a bit.
She reached out to me and I mirrored the action, my hand moving without my permission, drawn up as though lifted by a puppet string. My fingers were still curled into a fist around the keys. The long bone claw of her forefinger traced over the inside of my forearm, its tendons and veins, and her twisted metal thumbnail pressed into the bone of my wrist. She broke the skin and blood welled. I jerked my hand away, but she didn't let me go. My arm hit a jar. It toppled to the side, knocked into another. They both fell and shattered. The sand hissed and crawled away from the broken glass, rolling like worms toward her split black hooves. Not worms. Fingers. The sand gathered into the shape of a hand, twisting and reaching, fingers curling up from the stone. Lumps rose through the hand, and there was the shape of a nose, the curve of a jaw, mouths opening in silent screams, blank eyes, crumbling jaws, creeping along the floor, pressing against the glass. I tugged my hand again. Her thumb and forefinger pressed deeper into my wrist. The pain had been distant before, a mild sting, subdued and softened by the beseeching tone of her voice. But when I tried to break free, it surged to the surface in a flash of crippling agony. My entire arm was on fire, every muscle and tendon spasming in pain. I cried out and doubled over, but still she didn't let go. Blood flowed over my fingers and dripped to the floor. Where it struck the ground, the creeping sand recoiled and scattered. I hit her wrist with the flashlight, tried to break her grip, but she only laughed.
"Give it to me to keep," she said, still laughing. still laughing. It will be so happy here.
The pain spread up my arm, a white-hot cascade, and I could feel it in my skin, in my blood. Pure, mindless instinct had me sucking in quick, painful breaths, and my heart was beating wildly, out of my control. Every jolt of my pulse drew the gritty, hot press of her claws deeper into my body. Deeper. Deeper. Until her hand was part of my wrist. My arm was her arm. My heartbeat and her laughter. Her hunger and the cold, cold fear coiled deep in my gut. All the same, twinning together in an unbreakable tangle. And it hurt, it hurt, it hurt. But it would hurt worse to stop her. I couldn't stop her. I should just let her take it. Take me apart. Lock the dark, monstrous heart of me away. It was better that way. She would keep it safe. It was a good gift. The flashlight fell to the floor. Flickered. Blinked. But it didn't go out. I hadn't felt it slip from my fingers. But I heard the clatter. And I saw the yellow light momentarily fail. And in that brief space between noise and darkness, her voice faded from my mind, and the cries and pleas of all her victims, captured for me in Brian's memories, returned. She had made me forget them, but she couldn't silence them completely.
My dear,
she said. She wasn't laughing anymore.
Stay with Mother.
I grabbed the nearest jar and swung it at her face with all my strength. She shouted in surprise, and I grabbed another, and another, flung them at her head as quickly as I could. The first hit with a dull thunk. The second cracked, and sand slithered from the break. The third shattered, an explosion of shards slicing into my skin, and she bellowed with outrage. Her grip on my wrist loosened, and I flung another jar at her. This one aimed at her arm. She let go and I fell backward. I crawled after the flashlight and scrambled to my feet, turned as she was grasping at my shoulder, my upper arm, slicing through my shirt and my skin. I dove away from her, knocking jars down behind me, one after another. They crashed across the narrow tunnel, a racket of breaking glass and rasping sand. Her breathless laughter and the galloping clatter of hooves followed. I didn't remember the keys clenched in my fist until I saw the iron gate ahead. I pushed through the gate and swung it shut, but I wasn't fast enough. Her hand closed around my upper arm and she pulled me back, yanking my shoulder and head into the gate. The blow stunned me for a moment and I sagged, my head spinning, my legs weak. Her fingers were cold, her touch like ice, like wind off the lake on a winter day. Like the emptiness of space. I leaned into the iron bars and swung at her arm with the flashlight, hit her wrist with a loud crack of plastic on bone. She shrieked with laughter and slammed into the gate. Metal groaned, bolts ground against rock, and gravel showered around us. She was holding my arm and I couldn't pull free, so I grasped at her claws with my fingers. The blades cut into my hand, and her laughter was a cold mist, a falling night, a shadow, a suffocating, overpowering shadow. She had killed so many people. I let go of her claws and grabbed her wrist. Her face was inches from mine, her yellow eyes with those long black slits for pupils, her filthy skin. Her dark hair matted with dirt and mud and blood and straw. Her smile was wide and wet and red. She grinned with all of her teeth and shook me, hard, lifting my feet a few inches from the ground and knocking me against the gate. But I didn't let go. I held on, my bloody fingers on her clammy skin. And I pulled. I couldn't finish it. Couldn't do to her as I had done to the others. She was too strong. It was like trying to hold the ocean in the path of a tsunami. but I didn't need her to snap apart at my touch. I only needed to surprise her. Her laughter broke off with a gasp. I dropped to the ground, twisted, and lunged away. The flesh of my upper arm tore free of her claws. She rammed into the gate again, bellowing with fury. The agonized creak of metal and grind of rock lost under the strength of her cry. It filled the tunnel and made the mountain tremble. But I was already running. I jumped over the corpses, kicked through the skeletons, ran and ran and ran and didn't look back. Chapter 39. At the second gateway, I shoved the rock out of place, closed the gate, and locked it. My hands were shaking so badly it took me 3 tries before I got the right key. She was still shrieking. Sometimes it sounded like laughter, sometimes like screams, sometimes so loud it felt as though she were right behind me. I forced myself to look back. There was nothing in the tunnel behind me. No yellow eyes, no cloven hooves, no stoop-backed bundle of rags. But I didn't slow down. I kept running. I didn't know I was near the surface until the final gate was in front of me. I inhaled the clean scent of the forest, and it was the best thing I had ever smelled. I stumbled through the gate and shouldered it closed, took the padlock from my pocket and snapped it into place. It was such a little thing, a tiny metal lock. But I didn't have anything else. I pulled on the gate. It didn't budge. I rested my forehead against the cold iron and listened. I couldn't hear her anymore. I didn't remember when her screams had stopped, or if they had only faded with distance. 3 gates and 3 locks. I didn't know if it was enough. I shone the flashlight into the tunnel, almost certain I would see her yellow eyes. But there was nothing. There was only darkness. I kept the flashlight on as I made my way down the trail, past the old cabin, past Mr. Willow's body. I could barely look at him. He was a blink of khaki trousers and blood. My shoes kicked noisily through the underbrush and fallen needles. I stopped every few steps to listen to the babbling creek and the wind, to hold my breath and still my heart and wait. I waited to hear a laugh, a wet, rough cackle, bending iron, breaking glass, the whisper of sand on a stone floor, sand that had once been a person, or part of one, whatever parts Mother decided to keep for herself. The night was quiet. I walked faster. The wounds on my wrist and arm were closing. My fingers stung, but the blood was drying. They were far from the worst injuries I had received recently. I probably wouldn't even have scars. 1 mile or so from the mine, the old dirt road intersected another. There was a wooden fence and a metal farm gate. I climbed over and looked at the crooked private property sign before turning away. I had no idea which way to go, so I chose uphill, toward the starlight and the clear open sky. In the car, it had felt like we had driven forever into the heart of the mountains. But when I reached the top of the ridge, the city lights were close, bright and enticing just over the hills. I put Lyle's flashlight away and took Zeke's phone from my backpack. 2 rutted, unpaved roads met on that ridge. There were no houses nearby, no passing cars. But I did get a cell signal. I found the number for Jay and hit send. It rang a few times. Then there was a sleepy...
What?
I winced. Sorry. Jake? This is Breezy, from yesterday. Zeke gave me his phone and told me...
What the hell?
I'm sorry, I... Something rustled on the other end, followed by a soft thump and...
Wake up, asshole!
And a muffled...
Ow! It's the middle of the night, Zeke said.
He didn't sound like he had been asleep. It's... really? I looked at the phone screen. 3:46. It had been twilight when I went into the mine. I didn't realize.
What do you want? Are you okay?
Yeah, I said, my voice shaky. I'm fine. I'm just kind of stranded. I was wondering if you could give me a ride. Again. I mean, yeah, again. But I'm not all the way in Wyoming this time. And I swear I'm not going to try to blackmail you or anything, and there's something in it for you, at least, if you want. But I don't know how you usually...
What? Hey, stop. What are you talking about?
Dinner for a week, I said.
Zeke was quiet for a moment.
Where are you?
Oh, I have no idea. I was in the trunk when we drove up here.
The trunk?
Not my idea. Wait a sec. I had to cross the road to get a closer look at the signs. One was a name, the other a county road number. They're both dirt roads. There's nothing around here. But we didn't drive very far from Boulder, I don't think.
Zeke said something away from the phone, then came back and said,
Yeah, whatever, we can find it. Are you sure you're okay?
Yeah, definitely. Fine. Saying it three times absolutely made it more convincing.
Is there anybody else there?
No, just me.
Okay, we'll be there.
I tried to say, thank you, but he had already hung up. I put the phone in my pocket and sat down on my skateboard, hugged my legs to my chest. Even with the glow of the city lights, the sky was filled with stars. The Milky Way was a bright smear overhead. I tilted my head to the side to look at it edge-on, imagined myself floating in space outside the galaxy, seeing it as a massive, elegant spiral, and our sun as an insignificant speck. I spotted a satellite, gnat tiny and swift, and watched it until it disappeared behind the trees. Too slow to be the ISS. It was farther away. Lifeless. Empty. The wind rose. I shivered and rubbed my arms. Three gates. Three locks. It had kept her in for decades. She couldn't get out. I reminded myself to breathe.
Chapter 40.
I stood when I saw headlights and heard the growl of the truck's engine. Jake was driving. Zeke slid over to let me in the passenger side. They didn't ask me anything except,
Are you hurt?
And,
How far?
And I didn't offer anything more than, Not very. Jake stopped the truck in front of the gate. I jumped out to open it, but when I had my hand on the latch, metal cold beneath my fingers, I couldn't do it. The headlights cast long, distorted shadows over the narrow dirt road. Me, impossibly tall, and the horizontal bars of the gate like a silhouetted prison. The tunnel of trees stretched into the forest in shades of washed-out yellows and greens. Somehow that artificial light was worse than darkness would have been.
Breezy?
Zeke got out of the truck behind me, and a second later Jake did too.
What is it?
Jake said. The last thing I wanted to do was follow that road again. I was shaking my head before I realized what I was doing. I can't. I can't go back there. Even where I stood, in the light, behind the false security of a green farm gate, it was too close to the mine. Too close to her. We should leave, I said. But I couldn't turn around. That would mean putting my back to the forest and the road. My hand was still on the gate. I flicked the latch open and closed. Open and closed. We shouldn't be here. We need to go.
Okay,
Jake said gently. He put his hand over mine, didn't even flinch at the blood caking my fingers, and stopped the soft metal click of the latch.
Can you tell me what's up there?
I felt a burst of annoyance that he was talking to me like that. like I was a little girl afraid of the gaping black space beneath her bed. But it steadied me, too. It was better to be annoyed than addled with fear. "I'm not going back up there," I said. I tried to sound stubborn, not terrified. He wasn't fooled. "You want your dinner? Go get it yourself."
"Okay. Zeke can stay here with you. Tell me how to get there."
"It's past the end of the road. There's a trail. It goes over a creek. And this old cabin..." I pulled my hand away and turned to face Jake. "You can't go past the old cabin. Even if... he's there, by the old cabin. The body." I didn't want to say his name out loud. He wasn't a person anymore. There wasn't anything left of him except the memories I had stolen. "But you can't go past that point. You can't. For any reason. Don't go to the end of the trail."
"What's at the end of the trail?"
Jake asked. He wasn't afraid. Worried, yes, but mostly curious. "Something you're not going to see, because you're not going that far," I said. Jake hesitated, then shrugged.
"Fine, I won't."
"Promise me." At that, he started to look more concerned.
"All right, I promise."
It wasn't enough. "Promise him," I said, pointing at Zeke. "Promise him you won't go past the old cabin." Jake said,
"Okay, I swear to both of you that I won't go past the cabin. I'll be back in a few minutes."
I opened the gate for him, and he drove away. The red taillights disappeared into the forest.
"You are completely freaking out," Zeke said.
"I am not."
"Yes, you are. What's down there?"
"Will he be able to find it?" I asked. "It," because that was easier than him. I didn't give him very good directions. Does he even have a flashlight? Zeke's answer was wry.
"We're not good at much of anything, but finding dead bodies in the dark is one thing we can do."
"Oh, right. Makes sense." I inhaled slowly, tried to get control of my breathing, tried to slow my heart rate. It wasn't working. "Will he do what he said? Will he... I mean, he won't get curious or something? Keep going?"
"No, he'll come right back," Zeke said. "Maybe if he were alone, he'd do something stupid, but not with us waiting for him."
"You're sure?"
"I wouldn't have let him go if I wasn't."
"Okay, that's good. Okay." I felt exposed and unsteady standing there in the middle of the road. My knees felt shaky. My feet were sore. My head aching. The torn skin of my fingers stung with sweat and dirt. I was tired. I was so damn tired. I sat on the top rail of the fence and let my shoulders slump. Zeke said,
"What happened anyway? How did you get up here?"
"Violet," I said. "The girl I was looking for. I found her. She was having doubts about her life choices. She wanted me to do something for her."
"What do you mean?"
I didn't want to go through the whole afternoon. "It's a long story." Zeke came over to sit beside me on the fence.
"Why would you help her?"
"It's not like she was going to kill me."
"Someday you're going to get tired of saying that."
"I'm already tired of it. I've only been a reanimated corpse for a few weeks and I've already used up all my zombie jokes." I rubbed my hands over my face, regretted it when I felt the scrape of grit and dirt on my skin. "I don't want to talk about it. Not in the dark. Not in the mountains. Maybe in the morning, with the sun burning hot in the blue Colorado sky, miles away from the mine. Maybe then I would explain, if he still wanted to know. Not here." He wasn't going to leave it alone.
"But you went with her."